Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, good morning and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. I hope you enjoyed our 21-hour break. I am here live, would love to talk to you. My number is 888-914-9149. And yes, I have not forgotten, it is Taco Tuesday. May I say to you, Cyrus, have you ever been on an airplane, maybe, I don't know, like a commercial airliner traveling from one place to another? Did you ever give any thought to the possibility that the pilots up front might pass out? Or did that thought never cross your mind?
Yeah, it's never crossed my mind.
Nor mine. I have not thought about that until I saw this article in Popular Science, and although it doesn't deal with airline pilots, it deals maybe something even worse. Two fighter pilots passed out over Nevada last year, and thankfully there was no crash, no loss of life, because our ACE software, the avionics software, saved these pilots. This is an amazing story. Actually, two amazing stories rolled into one. On January 23rd of last year, a pilot flying a single-seat F-16 over Nevada lost consciousness. You don't really like, I don't like those words in the same words as a pilot flying a plane. I don't like to see the words lost consciousness in the same sentence.
No, I don't either. I've heard that when you have, what is it, the G's?
G-force.
Yeah. When it gets too extreme, it can knock someone out. Is that what's happening here?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure that as I will share the article with you, some of these details will become clear. Yeah, G-forces can certainly do that. They have blackouts and redouts, and I think that, I mean, any pilot can explain it to you better than I can. But as I understand it, you have when it's a centrifugal force and the blood is draining away from your head, or it's a centripetal force and the blood is coming toward your head, depending upon which way, you know, your body is in relation to the way the plane is moving. And so you can have a redout or a blackout. So here's what happened. So it says he lost consciousness. Around 6 months later, on July 16th, another pilot operating the same type of fighter jet, also in Nevada, passed out as well. Both of them would have certainly, or almost certainly, been killed were it not for built-in software that took over the controls when they crashed. Both pilots experienced an aviation phenomenon called G-lock, which stands for the G-induced loss of consciousness, G referring to gravity. And both were operating in the Nevada test and training range. In each case, the onboard software system saved the aviators' lives, according to the U.S. Air Force. The software that saved them is known as Automatic Ground Collision Avoidance System, or the AGCAS for short. In the case of the January incident, it engaged when the jet was about 2,600 feet above ground level. In the July incident, the software activated about 4,000 feet above ground level. The Air Force Safety Center explained to Popular Science that in both cases, this system is credited with saving the pilots' lives. They said in both incidents, the pilots were able to regain consciousness during this AGCAS pull-up. AGCAS, again, the Automatic Ground Collision Avoidance System. And they assisted in the recovery of the aircraft. However, their actions alone would not have been in time to prevent collision with the ground. Could you imagine being one of those pilots, and suddenly you're waking up to the realization that you had blacked out in an F-16 traveling who knows how fast, and suddenly you're waking up from it, and you're not waking up in the afterlife, you're waking up still alive because the software saved your life. I love this. I want this on every plane. I don't care how much it costs, put this on every plane. Referring to the altitudes above the ground at which the system engaged, the Safety Center said, based on the airspeed and flight paths of the aircrafts, these were the altitudes where the system calculated that immediate flight control input was needed to avoid a crash. Lockheed Martin, which manufactures F-16 and F-35 fighter jets, created this software. In simple terms, The code realizes when the jet is going to fly into the ground and it attempts to fix the problem. The defense behemoth, which also owns Sikorsky helicopters, describes how it works. The system consists of a set of complex collision avoidance and autonomous decision-making algorithms that utilize precise navigation, aircraft performance, and onboard digital terrain data to determine if a ground collision is imminent. If the system predicts an imminent collision, an autonomous avoidance maneuver, a roll to wings level, and a plus 5G pull is commanded at the last instant to prevent ground impact. I would prefer that they do it several instances before the last instance, you know, just in case. In the January 2020 event, the pilot was at an altitude of 15,800 feet when he succumbed to G-lock. The other pilot was at 17,000 feet. G-lock, as a fighter pilot.
Easy for you to say.
Fighter pilot. That's not even a word. Fighter pilot. As they experience it, they pass out like during a maneuver. And they have uniforms. I mean, or their what do you call them? The spacesuit, the suit that they wear in some cases, not a spacesuit. It can actually compress and expand in order to move blood in the right direction to the brain or away from the brain, I guess. They have also a special breathing exercise called the anti-G straining maneuver that they all learn how to do. They have the G suit, which is what I was trying to say a minute ago. It dynamically responds to what the jet is doing. It squeezes the pilot's body like a high-tech blood pressure cuff. These two tools together should keep the blood from pooling, you know, down at your feet. And if you don't get out of this situation, then the software takes over, which I think is great. I mean, obviously it's great. And I'm sure the pilots and their families are very grateful for that as well. So
have you driven a car that auto corrects? Like you start veering a little off to the right and it all of a sudden the wheel kind of nudges you over?
Not that I know. I don't think I have. But I did, within the last couple of months, I did rent a car. Nancy and I were someplace and we rented a car. And I kept hearing this kind of like a drrrr sound every so often and the steering wheel would shake. And I thought, there must be something wrong with this vehicle because something's loose. And it took me at least a day or so of driving this vehicle before I finally figured out what this is. This was like an anti-collision avoidance system where as the left side or the wheels or whatever of the car would get too close to the line, it would activate this system. Now, it didn't move the car, but it was intended to tell me that I was too close to the line. So when I would move in, then it would stop. But it took me at least a day before I understood what this meant. So it was a bit disconcerting at first. I thought the whole thing was going to come apart. But, you know, I like things like that. Personally, I think that that type of improvement is a welcome thing. I was trying to think of a God door for this story. You know, and it's not easy to come up with one because unlike equipment, you know, we don't have something that takes over and corrects the problem before you commit a sin. You know, that's where our free will is. The closest thing I could come to on this one, Cyrus, if you're racking your brain trying to think of a God door, the closest thing I could come to is the conscience. Each of us has our own conscience, and in your conscience, as the Catechism says, you are alone with God and you hear the voice of God speaking in your conscience. And conscience does not, you know, if somebody says, well, I've got to follow my conscience. For some people, I think what they mean by that is I'm going to do what I want to do. That's not your conscience. I'm going to do what I would like to do, what would be fun or pleasurable. That's not your conscience. The appetites, the tugs that you receive, as we all do, from emotion and appetite, that's not your conscience. Your conscience is that function of your soul. It's an operation of the soul that tells you that this act that you're contemplating committing, and I don't mean like belching after dinner. I'm not talking about something that is, you know, purely physical and has nothing to do with your intellect. A human act, strictly speaking, is a an act that is made on the basis of you as an acting agent, knowing that you either should or shouldn't do whatever the action is that you are contemplating. And it could be merely a mental action. It doesn't have to be a physical action, but the act that you're contemplating doing, your conscience is the operation of your soul that is like a warning bell that tells you, don't do that. There's something wrong with that. And it may not be immediately clear what it is that's wrong with that, but when your conscience bothers you and you know that you shouldn't do it, or you know, you don't necessarily know why you shouldn't do it, but you feel funny about it, like, I don't think I should do this. That's your conscience. And your conscience, if it's functioning properly, and also if it is well-formed, which is your duty to form your conscience well, that's going to get you out of a lot of scrapes and a lot of, you know, impact, where maybe nothing will be left of your life but a smoking crater where your marriage once was, or where your career once was, or where a friendship once was, or what have you. Often these smoking craters that are left after people make decisions is because they don't listen to their consciences. And we've all been there. I mean, I'm no different from anyone else. There have been times in my life when I didn't listen to my conscience. And if you've ever been in that situation, you know the pain that you experience later, because your conscience not only warns you before you do something, or tells you that you should do something before you do it, but it also reminds you, you did that thing. The conscience is also very important for you because it's a reminder to you of things that you've done. This is why we call them a guilty conscience, because a guilty conscience causes pain. It causes remorse and regret and anxiety and fear and shame and embarrassment, all the things that are, you know, human beings are prone to. The conscience is involved in doing that. But it does it, and this is why God created your soul this way. Your conscience functions that way to remind you to not do that again. Kind of like nerve endings in your body. The nerve endings are there. I mean, sometimes it would be really great if you didn't have nerve endings, right? If you did something, you know, you broke your ankle, or you did something else really terrible and it hurt so bad and you wish you didn't have nerve endings because then you wouldn't feel any pain. Okay, that, you know, there's a time and place when that seems like a good idea. But if you never had any nerve, if you didn't have any nerve endings, you would never really know when you had hurt yourself. And you could kill yourself or do severe damage to your body if you didn't experience pain. So the pain is not only a reminder, oops, I shouldn't have done that, but also don't do that again. So maybe that's the rough equivalent, I guess, of the collision avoidance system in these airplanes. Rely on your conscience, yes, obey your conscience, but you have to properly form your conscience. That means that you have an obligation to seek the truth and to know the truth. Jesus said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. So truth can be understood in a variety of ways. Moral actions, and let's just come back to that for a minute here. A moral action can be determined as to whether or not it's moral or immoral, kind of like that collision avoidance system on the airplane. It's with all of its complex algorithms and if this, then that, you know, the steps of if the plane discerns that this is happening, then it should do this. And I'm sure it's far more complicated than I could ever understand. But the general principle is the same, that the system in the plane is going to take action to avert a disaster. Well, your conscience can't do that, but it does the next thing, which is to warn you. And so when you're evaluating an action, maybe you're thinking about this, should I do this, shouldn't I do this? There are three major things to look at. And usually, almost always, when you stop and ponder these three elements of a human act, you can determine almost always, maybe not always, but almost always, whether or not this is something that is morally good or bad. First thing is your intention. What is your intention for doing this? So if your intention is to stick a knife in a guy because you're angry, well, that would be immoral because that would be causing grave bodily harm, perhaps even killing the person. But if your intention is to save his life by sticking a knife in him because you happen to be a surgeon, well, your intention is correct. Now, what about the act itself? So the act itself could be morally neutral. So sticking a knife in a guy, the act of puncturing somebody's body with a knife, I would say is in some circumstances, it's morally neutral or it's morally good. Because if you're the physician, if you're the surgeon, it's what's necessary in order to save the person's life. So the act of sticking a knife in a person may be good at times, may be bad at times. So the act itself has to be evaluated. What about an act that's always wrong, always and everywhere wrong, like, say, abortion? There is no situation where the act itself can become good. And so you've got the act itself, you've got your motivation, why are you doing this? And then the third thing would be, what are the circumstances? What are the circumstances under which you're actually doing the act or refraining from doing the act? And when you consider all of those things, it doesn't take long. Usually you can pinpoint pretty quickly, nah, this is not the right thing to do. I really shouldn't do this. Or I really should do this, but I'm kind of lazy and I don't feel like doing that. That's your conscience telling you. And, you know, if you look at the story of these pilots whose lives were saved and they went home to their wives and children that day, and the who knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars involved in these aircraft that they were flying, not to mention potential damage to people on the ground. All of that was averted because the system kicked in and operated the way it should. So for me, that's the God door. Think about how your internal guidance system operates. And if you need to update the software, that's where prayer and study come in. And you can update that software. The more you know, the more conscious you are of the decisions that you're making, the more you reflect upon it. The person who makes hasty decisions often makes bad decisions. In retrospect, maybe looking back and saying, oh, if I hadn't have been so hasty, maybe I wouldn't be in this jam right now. So take your time, think it through. Don't be afraid to say, this is wrong, I'm not going to do it, even though it would feel good. Or it would look good on my resume or whatever. If it's not good and you know it's not good, then avoid it, like the terrain. Well, we're going to take a break. We have plenty of phone calls to go to, although there are one or two lines open, which you can have if you want to grab one by calling 888-914-9149. We'll go straight back to the phone calls, or to the phone calls as the case may be, right after this quick timeout. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
I feel the need for speed. Ow!
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Thanks, Goose. You could be my wingman any day. Goose. You're supposed to say thanks, Maverick.
Thanks, Maverick.
You can call me Mav if you want. I'll allow that.
I knew you'd like it too much. I was like, oh, I don't want to do it.
Serious business, though. This is something serious, though. As we experienced a year of St. Joseph in 2021, this year we are doing something special by spending a year celebrating Our Lady with miracles, mysteries, and Mary. We're exploring Mary's intercession in human history and in our own lives every day. You can grow in faith, knowledge, and devotion to Our Lady through these lessons. Again, miracles, mysteries, and Mary. It's free. To receive the email series, and to get access to exclusive content that's only available to people who sign up for this, which is free, Go right now to relevantradio.com/Mary. That's relevantradio.com/Mary. Okay, to the phones. Let's go to Joe in Brooklyn. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Do you believe in a concept of a soulmate?
Tell me how you define the concept to make sure I understand what you're referring to.
Well, it's almost like the ancient Greek gods, where they believed that your soul has been split in half and that you constantly searching for your mate on the planet. I mean, some people say that's marriage, but others have a different take on it. Like you said, there are different opinions of it. I guess mine is, it's the other half of me, you know, as a soulmate, mm-hmm. the other half of my soul.
Well, that sounds, I mean, oh, go ahead. Did you have more you wanted to say, John?
No, go ahead. I wanted to hear what your take was.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's break it down. First of all, I am familiar with that idea. I don't hold that view myself, but for this reason, and when I say let's break it down, this is what I mean. You yourself are a composite. I mean, all of us as human beings are. We're a composite of body and soul. So to be fully you, your body and your soul are joined together. This is, of course, is what makes death so frightening to us, because at the deepest levels, we realize how unnatural it is for the body and the soul to separate. The soul is the form of the body. And so without the soul, the body is just a meaningless, you know, husk of parts that doesn't really do anything. But if you consider your soul as such, your soul is simple in the sense that it can't be divided. Your soul, the spiritual part of you, is indivisible. It's also, it doesn't take up space. It doesn't extend into space. It's utterly simple in this sense, meaning that there are no parts to it. Your soul is all one thing. So for that reason, your soul can't be divided. It's not as though when you were about to be conceived or at the moment of your conception, which is, I guess, what would have to happen if this theory were true, is that your soul would have to be cleaved in two somehow. But it can't be, because your soul is simple. There are no parts to it. So just on that basis alone, I think although the idea, excuse me, this romantic idea of a soulmate appeals to us, and understandably so, if there's somebody out there for you who would complete you as a, you know, that's a kind of a cliche now, you complete me. I'm not sure what movie that came from, but I understand the concept of it or even the emotion of it, but strictly speaking, no, there's no other part of your soul out there waiting to be reattached to you, because there's only one you. Rather, the person that you wind up with, if you get married, or, I mean, even if you don't get married, if you fall in love with somebody, that person can fulfill you in countless ways, but it's not as though it's a piece of you that's being reattached to you. It's the other person's complementarity and the love that you have for each other and so on. So does that make sense? Even if you don't necessarily, you know, hold that view, does that make sense where I'm coming from?
100%. And I asked this to a Jesuit priest also, but he didn't really give me an in-depth explanation. He just said he doesn't believe in it, you know, and it happened to be just real quickly after Mass. But you have clarified it very much for me. Thank you very much for your time.
I feel like I've done my good deed for the day. Thank you, John. Appreciate that. 888-914-9149 is the number. Soulmate. I mean, it's a great thought that the person that you wind up with is your soulmate, in that you are made for each other. But that leads to another question that Joe didn't ask, but I'll raise it anyway. Is there only one person for you? Did God create, as he does, he created all the angels, and God has assigned an angel to you. Jesus said so. You have a guardian angel. So is it like that? Does God also create, when he creates all of humanity, certain people who are made for each other and nobody else? That's a question that I don't feel qualified to answer. I don't know that any human being can say yes or no definitively. But if I had to lean in one direction or the other, I would say no. My hunch is that God indeed, according to his providence, very often will bring people together who, in retrospect, when they look back on it, they realize just how wonderful they are together, just how happy they are together, and all the other things that go into a loving, happy, long-term relationship. Some people, they never find that person. Maybe she gets married to a guy that's just not that. He's just not, you know, that interested. And so perhaps they have a lackluster marriage. God bless the people who live in a marriage like that, who are heroic and they make the best of a situation that's not what they would prefer, but they make the best of it because they remain faithful to each other. That's a form of heroism, if ever there were any. But every so often, there are couples who are just sort of magnetically, powerfully, palpably good for each other and bring joy to each other and happiness. And when you get around people like that, you know it. Have you ever been around a marriage like that, Cyrus, where you just sort of say, and I don't mean to ask the question to suggest that you don't have a marriage like that. I don't mean it in that sense, prescinding from all that. But isn't it true when you're around couples that are just in love with each other? It shows, doesn't it? You can tell. And it's kind of neat to be around people like that, isn't it?
It's awesome, yeah. Yeah, I work with people that have marriages like that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you saying so. Nice of you.
Yes, you definitely, but I wasn't just talking about you.
I know. I couldn't resist, though. You gave me an opportunity. If I see daylight, I'm taking a shot. But no, I agree with you. It's edifying. And, you know, I think that's another great thing for younger couples or even those who are not married yet to have a mentor or more than one couple that's a mentor so they can see, witness to them what that looks like. It's a beautiful thing.
You.
What's that, Cyrus?
Complete me.
You sounded... I trampled it. I'm sorry. Go ahead and play it again.
I trampled on it.
I didn't even know what it was, and I was trampling again. I'll be quiet.
His pause is so long.
But you got to play it a little louder.
Oh, all right. I just lost it. Just move on. Oh, it's a little man. Jerry Maguire. So those that know.
All right. 888-914-9149. How about Rhonda in Dubuque, Iowa? Good morning, Rhonda.
Yes, good morning. Kind of not a question, it's just a comment, but it's in the form of a question. Okay. This is food for thought, where would we be as a society if Jesus had been aborted?
Well, to me, that question is like saying, where would we be if we all had wings? You know, we don't have wings, we'll never have wings, we would never have wings. But if we had wings, I imagine we could just theorize what it would be like. But to me, this is that kind of a question where it just wasn't God's plan that happened. And so it wouldn't happen. It couldn't happen as a result. But let's do the thought exercise. If Jesus had been aborted, think about what that would mean. That would mean then that either his mother, Mary, the Immaculate One, free from all sin, spouse of the Holy Spirit, that she either would have consented to that, or that if it were not her consent, then that would mean that it had been done against her will, in which case we have even more problems because God protected Mary from all things, including sin. And so there'd be no possible way that she could decide to do something so heinous and sinful. Or the other option would be if this was something done to her, and she was unwilling, and yet it was done to her, like those forced abortions in China, because the government didn't want couples to have more than one baby. Well, then that, of course, would present another problem, because then that would mean that some human being was able to subvert and overthrow God's plan of happiness and peace for the Blessed Virgin Mary, which would be impossible. So I don't know any other way to think about this, because abortion would entail one or the other of those scenarios, both of which would be impossible, seems to me.
Correct. But my asking the question is just to maybe make people, if my question would change even one person's thought, if they're thinking of this, that is why I asked the question, so that maybe, you know, if even one life would be saved because they thought for a second, you know, even just, you know, reflected upon that question, that maybe it might change their mind in having an abortion. That was the only reason I asked that question.
Well, your motive is good. I mean, now that you've spelled out your motive, that's laudable to try to get someone's attention so that they would stop and think, oh, wait a minute. We shouldn't do that. That's good. It just happens to be one of those questions that is unanswerable, it seems to me.
Right.
But I get where you're coming from.
Okay.
I can see your point.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Rhonda. Thank you. Interesting thing, not about this directly, but St. Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Theologiae, he actually discussed some of these what-if questions, like, you know, what if Adam and Eve hadn't fallen, if they hadn't committed the original sin? So he entertained questions like, would Jesus still have come? Would the second person of the Trinity still been incarnated? Would he have come to live with us? His answer was yes, but it would have been for different reasons. It wouldn't have been for the reason to save the whole world, because the whole world would not be in need of salvation if Adam and Eve had passed the test. But it is interesting to consider some of these what-if questions. We don't know the answer, and we won't know the answer until we get to heaven. But there all will be revealed, which is great. 888-914-9149. How about Tony, who just popped in California? Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for all you do. Love Relevant Radio. And
thank you.
I have a question, and I don't know if this question's ever been asked before. I am a deacon in the diocese here, and I often preach about my own mortality. I am a father. I am happily married. I look forward to dying. Is this normal?
Well, St. Paul said that while I am in the body, I am absent from the Lord, but I would rather be present to the Lord and absent from the body. So there we see an example of St. Paul expressing what sounds to me like what you're saying, that he had a desire to go and be in heaven. He would prefer to be in heaven rather than to be here. That was his preference, but he would be here for as long as God kept him here. So that can't be a bad, you know, there can't be something wrong with that, to desire to be in heaven with the Lord. So at first glance, no, I don't see anything inherently problematic about that. Has somebody told you that it is problematic?
No, absolutely not. You know, you get those strange looks. You know, I pray the good Lord gives me many more years. You know, I like to see my kids get married, walk my daughter down the aisle, and continue to serve the Lord as humbly and as lovingly as I can here on earth. But, you know, as we all know, this is just part-time. We are a part-timers here. And
right.
So, yeah, thank you, Patrick, for the clarification. Love the show. Love Catholic Radio. God bless you for all you do, and keep doing God's work.
Kind of you, Tony. Very kind of you. Thank you. Yes, and may God grant you many happy years of family and ministry. And, you know, when we both get to heaven, let's look each other up, shall we? And we'll compare notes, and I have a feeling we'll both really like it up there.
Amen. And who knows? Maybe next time you come out to SoCal, we can have a taco or a purpose-driven cup of coffee.
I would love a purpose-driven, either of the two. Hey, by the way, I will be out there in the next few months. So when the time comes, I'll probably post an announcement on Twitter. I usually post announcements about where I'm going to be speaking around the country on Twitter. So something is in the mix right now for Southern California, and I'll mention it on Twitter when the time comes. Maybe I'll see you there.
Sounds great, Patrick. I don't have Twitter, but I listen to Catholic Radio, Relevant Radio, and I also look at the events on the app. So
very
I
good.
Shall do that, and may God continue to bless you and your family.
Thanks, Tony. I appreciate that. Very kind. 888-914-9149. I have some good news. Well, I consider this good news. Now, you may say, if you have cataracts, I've got good news for you. And you're saying, what? Cataracts doesn't sound like good news. Well, there's an angle here that I want to share with you. And when I come back from this quick timeout, I will do so. I've had, the obligatory eye exam every year for most of my life. And the last time I went in, the doctor said, now, don't be alarmed. There's nothing to worry about. There's nothing, but I can see the faint traces of cataracts. And he says, this is very common as people get older. Most all people have this issue. Now, for some people, it becomes a problem. For many people, it doesn't become a problem. He said, just be aware of it. And there's nothing you need to do. Don't change your lifestyle or anything. But just be aware of it. And he says, I probably tell 9 out of 10 people your age the same thing. So that got my attention. And that's why when I read this article about cataracts, but something actually about cataracts that has nothing to do with cataracts that could actually help you with a different issue, I'll share with you what that is. It's a mystery right now. You don't know what it is, but I will share with you what it is. And I'll give you a hint. It does affect more and more and more people every year. More and more and more people are falling into this situation every year. And there is something connected to cataracts that could help you in that other area. Are you curious? Well, I'll tell you what that is when we come back from this quick timeout. Don't miss it. I'll be right back. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a new free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
See what I did there?
I do. And I saw what you, I heard what you did on the out as well. With I Can See for Miles and Miles. So you're into the cataract story, aren't you?
I'm out of puns.
Yeah.
Just let me hit buttons.
By the way, cataract is also a synonym for waterfall. So totally different meaning there. Okay, are you ready, everybody?
So don't go chasing cataracts?
Ooh, a little Paul McCartney.
I don't know. That was...
That's from McCartney 2.
Is
don't
that?
Don't go chasing waterfalls.
No, that's the... I don't even know who it is. That was like a...
It's Paul McCartney.
Don't go chasing waterfalls. Stick to the rivers and the streams that you're used to. Somebody help me out. I don't know who did that song, but it
Look
definitely wasn't Paul McCartney.
2. Probably his worst album ever. And I love Paul McCartney. I revere Paul McCartney, but that was one of the worst albums ever. When did that come out? 1980, maybe? And he's got a song on there called Don't Go Chasing Waterfalls. It's actually called Waterfalls, but that's the refrain. Don't go chasing waterfalls.
This is news to me.
All right, let's get back to the iVersion. So this is from dnyuz.com. Surgery to remove cataracts, which cause the eye's normally clear lens to become cloudy, can restore vision almost instantaneously. New research, though, suggests that, are you ready? Cataract surgery may have another benefit as well, and that is a reduced risk for Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. This is important. In this study, scientists looked at 3,038 men and women with cataracts who were 65 or older, and they were dementia-free at the time of their diagnosis. Of these, okay, so the total, keep these numbers in mind now. So the total population of the study was 3,038 men and women. Of the 3,038 men and women who were studied, 1,382 had cataract surgery. So they all had cataracts. 1,382 of them, not quite half, had cataract surgery, and the rest did not have cataract surgery. All of the subjects were part of a decades-long memory study that followed them over decades. The researchers found that the overall risk for dementia was 29% lower in those who had cataract surgery compared with those who did not. So they all had cataracts. They were all in that same age cohort. They were all studied over a long period of time. Not quite half of them had the cataract surgery, and the other more than half didn't have it. And in the case of those who had cataract surgery, their incidence of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia were down by nearly 30%. I think that's great news. The researchers also looked at glaucoma surgery, another type of eye operation that does not restore vision but can help prevent vision loss. And they found that it had no effect, at least as far as they could see. And I didn't mean that as a pun, but I couldn't help myself, on dementia. The study in the JAMA, Internal Medicine, the Journal of American Medical Association, I believe it is, adjusted for age at first diagnosis of cataracts as well as various risk factors for dementia, including few years of education, smoking, high body mass index, hypertension. The only trait they found that had a bigger impact on dementia risk than cataract surgery was not carrying a gene called the APOE-E4 that is linked to increased risk of Alzheimer's. Maybe we should all get checked for that gene. I don't know. Dr. Nathaniel Chin, an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Wisconsin, who was not involved in the study, said, "The authors were incredibly thoughtful in how they approached the data and considered other variables. They compared cataract surgery to non-vision improving surgery, in this case glaucoma surgery, and controlled for many important confounding variables." Dr. Cecilia Lee, an associate professor of ophthalmology at the University of Washington and also the lead author of the study, she said, "We were astounded by the magnitude of the effect. People might say that those who are healthy enough to have surgery are healthier in general and therefore less likely to develop dementia in any case, but when we see no association in glaucoma surgery, that supports the idea that it isn't just eye surgery or being healthy enough to undergo surgery, but rather that the effect is specific to cataract surgery." As Dr. Spock would say, fascinating. The findings bolster earlier research showing that vision loss as well as hearing loss are important risk factors for cognitive decline. People who have trouble seeing or hearing, for example, may withdraw from activities like exercise, social interactions, reading, or intellectual pursuits, all of which are tied to a lower risk of dementia. But researchers also suggested a possible physiological mechanism. The visual cortex undergoes changes with vision loss, they wrote in the paper, and impaired vision may lessen input to the brain, leading to brain shrinkage, also a risk factor for dementia. So I'm loving it. I think this is great news. And obviously they're going to do more study to see if they're, you know, what else they can determine from this, but you know, maybe if you find, you know, what's the old saying, that when God closes a door, he opens a window. So it may be that if you find yourself needing cataract surgery, the upside very well may be that by getting cataract surgery, you may ward off some of the risk of dementia. Win-win. Better eyesight and warding off the risk of dementia. That sounds like a good combination to me. So this article, as with all the other ones, is posted at the show Twitter feed, at P Madrid Show. You can also access it by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and you can access everything there. Let's go to Corpus Christi now and talk to Gino. Good morning, Gino.
Good morning, Patrick. I don't know if it's Taco Tuesday or not. Haven't heard anything yet.
Well, I did mention it in passing at the beginning of the show, but I could understand if you didn't hear from the very beginning.
Okay.
But yeah.
Well, I have a threefold question, and if that's okay, the first part is, who or what exactly brought death into our world? And the second part is, was it God's will or was it human will? And thirdly, if death hadn't been brought into the world, would our planet have enough space to for everybody to live? I don't know. This is one of your what if questions, but it's always pondered in my head, is like, if there was no death, you know, people would be 100,000 years old or whatnot, and or would everybody fit, if that makes sense.
Let's take them in order. Let's take them in order. So the first question is, if I remember correctly, how did death come into the world? Is that the question?
Right. Or what? Who or what exactly brought death into the world?
Okay. So St. Paul speaks directly to that issue, at least in terms of human death. And there's a little bifurcation here I'd like to make in a moment. But in Romans chapter 5, beginning verse 12, he says, "Therefore, as sin came into the world through one man," referring to Adam, "and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all men sinned. Sin indeed was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not counted where there is no law. Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sins were not like the transgressions of Adam, who was a type of the one to come." So what we see, there's so much going on here that, I mean, we could spend an hour talking about it, but the answer to your question, I think, is succinctly said here, that death to the human race came through the sin of Adam. By his sin, he, in essence, spurned, he forsook those great gifts that God had intended for all human beings and that Adam and Eve had themselves, but they forfeited as a result of the sin, and that included not just immortality in a bodily sense, but it also included a right relationship with God. that would have been perfected with the beatific vision if Adam and Eve had passed their test, which they failed, but if they had passed it, then this condition that we know as original sin would not have come into the world, as St. Paul says. Now, this bifurcation I'd like to make is the following. This leaves open, however, the question about what about death as such? What about the death of insects? What about the death of animals, dinosaurs, plants, trees, you know, any living creature, presuming that there was a long period of time before Adam and Eve were created by God, there would have been death galore, but that would have been a different kind of death than what St. Paul's speaking about here. So as I read Romans chapter 5, and I'm answering your question, I want to make the distinction that this is referring to the death of humanity, both spiritually and physically. So there's my answer to the first part of the question. What was the second part again?
I guess you answered already, if it was God's will, but I was just a little confused because I didn't know if it was Adam who, if it was Adam or Eve who brought, because Eve's the one who, you know, got from the forbidden fruit or the forbidden tree, but it was Adam who, I guess, didn't keep her from that. Because she was tempted by Satan.
Yeah, let's read the passage. So this is Genesis 3, verse 1. And it says, "Now the serpent was more subtle than any other wild creature that the Lord had made, that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, 'Did God say you shall not eat of any tree of the garden?' And the woman said to the serpent, 'We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.' So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband, and he ate. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man and said to him, 'Where are you?' And he said, 'I heard the sound of thee in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself.' He said, 'Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree which I commanded you not to eat?'" Now I'll pause here, because obviously God is asking questions that he already knows the answers to. It's not as though God was waiting to find out what had happened. But this was the discourse with Adam and Eve to reveal to them what they had actually done. So verse 12, "The man said, 'The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me the fruit of the tree, and I ate.' Then the Lord God said to the woman, 'What is this that you have done?' The woman said, 'The serpent beguiled me, and I ate.' The Lord God said to the serpent, 'Because you have done this, cursed are you above all cattle and above all wild animals. Upon your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat for the rest of your life.'" So then from that point forward, he gives the maledictions, the curses that are pronounced, including pain and childbearing and all the other things. Then in verse 17, he says to Adam again. To Adam, he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life." So the reason for going through this passage at length is to point out, number one, the sequence of what happened. So the serpent tempted Eve. Eve ate the fruit. She was beguiled by the serpent. And the language here suggests that not only did they not go to the tree to eat of it before this, but they didn't even apparently look at it. It seems from verse 6 that she suddenly realized that this looked delightful, and she was beholding this fruit maybe for the very first time. And to me, that suggests that when God told Adam and Eve, everything here is for you except for that tree, leave that alone. So they were so obedient that they didn't even look at it, it seems. But this is what happened in terms of the chronology, but it was in Adam that all men sin. So to tie this passage back into Romans chapter 5, St. Paul says that it was because Adam, who was not beguiled by the serpent, he was not dazzled and confused. Rather, in the stone-cold, sober light of day, he knew exactly what he was doing, and he did it anyway. And it was in Adam, therefore, that all of us wind up in the condition of original sin. So what was the third part of your question, Gino? Because I've got to take a break in about 2 minutes.
Right, I understand. Thank you for that. So I guess it's maybe it's irrelevant, but the third part was, had that not happened and there was not death in the world, would this planet have been sustained? Or I guess it was just God's will for that to happen.
Well, it wasn't God's will that they sinned, because if it were God's will that they sinned, then that would make God the author of evil, and God is all good. So he can't be the author of evil. He can permit this, but he wouldn't proactively will it for that reason. So this is a question that's impossible to answer, only because the Garden of Eden, what was that exactly? Was that a special place on earth that was protected in a supernatural way from the things going on the rest of the earth? Or was the entire earth that way? It's impossible to know, and Scripture doesn't really give us any details at that level. So I guess what we could say is the earth as we know it was what was the human reality that Adam and Eve found themselves in. But there's just no way to know, I'm afraid, what the Garden of Eden entailed. It's a mysterious and wonderful thing to consider, but God hasn't revealed to us those specifics. I hope that's helpful, Gino, and I appreciate the phone call. Taco Tuesday being what it is. Thank you for that. I'll be right back with Hour 2 right after this.